KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, after years of layoffs and service cuts, city budgets are recovering, so why is no one celebrating? Plus, a wilderness area near Napa is in line for federal environmental protections, but not everyone is happy.
All the federal agencies can better coordinate and better work together to get more bang for the taxpayer dollars. Now, how in the world anybody could be opposed to that is beyond me.
Also, our graduation day series continues with a high school student who has to choose between basketball and Mormon missionary work, and how farmers are using social media to put excess crops to good use.
I don't believe we should let it go to waste. I believe we should share it, donate it, whatever it takes.
It's the California Report. Everywhere you look in California, seems there are signs of economic recovery. Statewide unemployment rate, down. State revenues, up, way up. And at city council meetings across California, public officials are saying the worst is over. It got us wondering, now that cities are seeing light at the end of the tunnel, how are they setting their spending priorities, and what have they learned? Few cities have seen the bloodletting San Jose has, a decade of severe budget cuts, year after year after year. At a city council meeting 3 years ago, dozens of speakers, including Louis Rocha Jr., lined up to plead for saving things like libraries, youth centers, and programs for people with learning disabilities.
I believe we can find a way to balance this budget without pitting people against each other. Creative solutions will save services. Thank you for your time.
By comparison, a community budget hearing in San Jose last week was practically serene. Soft jazz played over loudspeakers at a high school gym as Mayor Chuck Reed ticked off new spending plans.
This year we were able to open four libraries that had been padlocked, brand new, never used. And we added another 800 streetlights we've turned on already this year from those we turned off to save money. So it's getting a little better.
Like most cities in California, San Jose isn't out of the woods yet. Mayor Reed blames state officials who increased pension benefits for state workers during the dot-com boom, changes that trickled down to the local level.
The state of California acted as if it was rich and we didn't have to worry about a thing, and the stock market was going to keep going up and up and up, and that was just totally unrealistic.
City Manager Deborah Fagoni says San Jose has cut $680 million and 2,000 positions out of its budget over the past decade, adding there's still a $3 million shortfall this year. But at least there are no more layoffs.
We now have staffing levels at the same level that we had in 1988-89 when the population was 250,000 less people. So our ability to deliver services has drastically changed.
Residents have really felt the impacts.
Supervisor Pete Constant has represented the west side of San Jose since 2007.
You know, the first few years you can survive a deficit by trimming around the edges, do some consolidations, find some efficiencies. But when you go into a decade of budget problems, you really get these service cuts that hit people right in their face. I mean, they can see them every single day.
Resident Robin Helf would agree with that. Like others who showed up at last week's meeting, public safety was on the top of her mind. She and her neighbors are unhappy about police response to a recent rash of burglaries.
They are told, even when they have fingerprints and ample evidence, that, sorry, we don't have the detectives to sort through this, investigate it, and use it and pursue it further.
Max Nyman studies the finances of California cities. His take? Even as local revenues recover, there's a kind of lingering shell shock on the part of city officials.
I think all of them are very cautious in this environment because they found this experience to be so painful in terms of service cutbacks, laid off employees, furloughed employees. There was a lot of bloodshed.
Nyman notes that while state government relies heavily on the volatile income tax, which falls and rises quickly with the economy, local government depends on sales and property taxes, which plunged during the home foreclosure crisis and haven't recovered. Michael Coleman with the League of California Cities says the deep recession and slow recovery have forced many cities to do things they never would have considered in the past.
You've seen folks go in and do major restructurings, and not just in libraries or street pavement or parks and recreation, but really getting into the public safety service area.
That's what happened in the city of San Carlos on the northern edge of Silicon Valley. 3 years ago, after voters rejected repeated ballot measures to raise taxes, city leaders took drastic measures to close a $3.5 million deficit. The targets, said Assistant City Manager Brian Mora, were three agencies previously considered sacred cows.
You know, in the case of park maintenance, we contracted with a private sector company. In the case of fire, we actually broke up a shared department and recreated our own. And in the case of police, we contracted with the sheriff.
Disbanding its own police department and restructuring fire caused a firestorm of criticism, especially from public employee labor unions who feared layoffs and pay cuts. But a funny thing happened, says Mora. Relying on the county sheriff for law enforcement meant the city didn't have to pay for extra police officers to cover those on vacation, disability, or sick time. The county did that for them.
Suddenly, we were getting three and four officers on a shift always, whereas before, we'd budgeted for that many, but if something happened, well, we didn't always get what we had shown in the budget.
In fact, Mora says, the city had what he calls excess savings, which they invested back into things like traffic enforcement and a sports league for local kids. It worked out well, but experts say this kind of restructuring can be risky if it's done wrong. Still, 3 years after revamping government services, Mora says other cities in the county have followed the lead of San Carlos.
You know, it would be difficult to go back to those other models, in part because we now see that the arrangements we have in place today are giving us, in most cases, a higher level of service for less cost.
But many cities and counties are still putting off tough, unpopular decisions. Reserves are depleted. Most importantly, says Michael Coleman with the League of California Cities, local governments must come to grips with long-term costs for employee pensions and retiree health care.
Cities that are well-managed are taking on the hard news and the hard realities of making sure that those programs are funded and not waiting for those bombs to blow up in their face. And I think that the cities that we're going to have problems with in the next 5 or 10 years are the ones that are still in denial.
In fact, San Bernardino recently became the third major city in California to declare bankruptcy after failing to balance its budget. And in Los Angeles, labor unions attacked Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa's call to eliminate a 5.5% salary increase for city workers. And still sitting out there, local impact of sequestration. Across the board, federal budget cuts that are just now trickling down to local government programs, putting yet another dent in their bottom lines. Just as things are looking up. Just north of the San Francisco Bay Area is a vast expanse of land and water that could be in line for new federal protections. The proposed Berryessa Snow Mountain National Conservation Area would link wilderness zones and other lands in 5 counties. But as KQED's Craig Miller reports, it's been a tough sell in some quarters.
On one of those rare crystalline mornings, a small group gathers in front of a coffee shop in the town of Winters, about 30 miles west of Sacramento.
So thank you all for showing up.
But they won't be lingering here over lattes.
So the plan for the day is to go up to Cold Canyon.
They're here to take a hike. Bob Schneider of the conservation group Tuliomi is laying out the plan.
We're going to hike up to the ridge for the views.
Views of what could become the nation's newest national conservation area, tucked into the nether region between I-5 and Highway 101. Nearly 350,000 acres of federal land would get permanent protection from mining activity, sale to commercial developers, and it's a bit unclear what else. Tuliomi's promotional handout calls the region a largely undiscovered national treasure. Michael Bruhn agrees.
It goes up about 100 miles to the north to Snow Mountain.
The national head of the Sierra Club has thrown his weight behind the move to set aside this expanse.
You've got beautiful, you know, wintering habitat for bald eagles, tule elk are here.
Compared to the nation's 16 existing national conservation areas, it would be among the biggest. A patchwork of lands variously managed by the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, and Bureau of Reclamation, pulling in three already designated wilderness areas and a sizable chunk of the Mendocino National Forest.
It's a place that is close to Sacramento, close to the Bay Area, but very wild.
Even if you hike up one of the ridges off the highway east of Napa, the area stretches literally farther than the eye can see, on most days at least. The Snow Mountain Wilderness area is 100 miles to the north. Down here at the south end, the conservation area would encircle Lake Berryessa, a 16,000-acre reservoir and recreational magnet in this part of the state. And that's where it gets interesting.
I say this just doesn't qualify.
Peter Kilkus publishes the Lake Berryessa News website from his 60-acre homestead overlooking the lake. He and some other landowners and business interests have opposed the NCA, saying it's just not necessary. California's first national conservation area was also the nation's first, the King Range, along the stretch of Northern California known as the Lost Coast. To qualify, areas are supposed to be nationally significant landscapes.
If you look at this proposed NCA, especially the south end at Lake Berryessa, this in no way falls under what would be considered suitable for a national conservation area. In my opinion, it's totally man-made in the first place.
True, Berryessa is not a natural lake. It was created in 1957 when the Bureau of Reclamation penned up Poudre Creek with the 300-foot-high Monticello Dam.
Before the lake was here, it was a huge farming community, and then they built a dam, kicked all the people out, and they put in a lake. Even the fish are not indigenous.
But down here at the south end of Berryessa, the conflict doesn't seem to be about fish. To many, the thrum of jet skis and powerboats is the pulse of the Lake Berryessa economy, an economy that has suffered in recent years. At first, the proposed NCA set off alarms that this kind of motorized recreation might be banned. Others worried that it might mean more restricted access to the lands themselves.
It doesn't affect anybody's private property. It's federally owned property.
This is the second time that Democratic Congressman Mike Thompson has put up a bill to designate this swath of land as an NCA. Barbara Boxer has a similar bill in the Senate.
We're providing this designation so all the federal agencies can better coordinate and better work together to get more bang for the taxpayer dollars. Now, how in the world anybody could be opposed to that is beyond me.
Go ahead.
By tweaking the bill, sponsors have managed to satisfy Marty Rodden, who runs the boat rentals at Markley Cove.
Sit down. We're going. Sit down. Everybody sit.
This time, lawmakers wrote in a promise not to tinker with motorized recreation on the lake.
I hope so. Because considering otherwise, this is how I make my living, and I'll be out of business.
Rodden says he's hopeful that once under a new management plan, some of the abandoned resorts around the lake might come back.
There's a lot less going on up here. I believe there was about 1 million visitors a year, and I think we're probably down to 250,000. So it's taken a really hard hit on everybody.
But Peter Kilkus and others around Lake Berryessa are still skeptical. They're concerned that once the land is redesignated, the government might yield to pressure from wilderness advocates and change the rules.
If you read the guiding documents behind a national conservation area, and you actually read them, it gives the government huge latitude to do almost anything they want.
In Washington, the bill will confront another group of skeptics. It now goes to the House Natural Resources Committee, which has not been real receptive of late to designating new protected lands. For the California Report, I'm Craig Miller at Lake Berryessa.
Today, as part of our graduation day series, we meet a young man who's prepared his whole life for two very separate goals, always believing he could do both during his lifetime. Only now, he has to choose. Molly Gray reports on what happens when religion and basketball collide.
It's the last practice before playoffs. McKay Anderson cuts to the basket and sneaks around a defender. He takes a pass from the wing and fires a jump shot from outside the key. A perfect basket.
What I love most about basketball is the feel for the ball, really. I mean, it sounds kind of weird, just kind of feeling the ball before the game or something like that, or just looking at it and just picturing yourself doing well.
Anderson is a senior at Laverne Lutheran High School, about 35 miles east of Los Angeles. Ever since he could walk, he's played basketball. Every drop of sweat and every three-hour practice is what keeps him going. So it seemed as if he had only one place to go after graduation, the court of a Division I basketball program. But as he looks to the future, there is something else calling out to him.
Our kind Heavenly Father, we're very grateful for this day. We're grateful for all the many blessings that Thou hast given us.
Anderson is a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and he wants to serve a two-year mission preaching the gospel of his church.
I've known that I've always wanted to go on a mission.
So why would a young kid want to give up his social life, college education, and even time with his family? In the Mormon church, there's a long history of sending out missionaries. At a recent service, his congregation sang a traditional Mormon hymn about going where the Lord wants them to go. Many members say it's their duty to share what they believe with others.
Not too many people have the experience or the opportunity to actually read the Book of Mormon, so it's just an opportunity to try and convert people and to try and to help them kind of gain a different perspective.
Anderson says he wants to do his part because the church has done so much for him.
Just similar to like basketball chemistry, it just shows you how devoted they are to helping one another.
But he had a decision to make. Should he delay his college basketball career and go now, or should he disrupt it after a year or two on the court? Anderson worried that the other recruits would have an advantage over him if he waited to play, but he also wondered.
Would it be good to go on a mission and come back and mature a little bit more, physically, mentally, and spiritually?
But then one day, something happened that put things in perspective. In a tournament last summer, Anderson broke his leg. His doctors assured him he would make a full recovery, but all of the coaches that had been recruiting him disappeared. All but one, Coach Nick Robinson of Southern Utah University.
I really liked his aggressiveness. We felt that it was, in our best interest, as a program to continue to recruit him.
Robinson offered Anderson a scholarship and he accepted, and eventually made it back onto the court. Feeling more grateful than ever for the ability to play, Anderson had to decide which would come first, basketball or missionary work. He talked things over on the living room couch with his parents.
What are your guys' thoughts on me going on a mission or going to school first?
Well, I think it's very important to, number one, have in your mind the fact that you're going on a mission. That's the most important thing.
But it was overall, it was up to me, and I kind of had to figure out that for myself.
Okay. In the meantime, Anderson had to lead his team on a run for the playoffs. At a recent game, Roger Anderson and his wife Lisa fought the urge to pace as their son's team tried to stave off a comeback by the opposition.
This is what high school basketball is all about. A minute to go, we're up by one. Last game of the season before CIF playoffs. Doesn't get any better than this.
With seconds left, Anderson's team trailed by 1 point. Anderson saw his teammate open at the baseline and he fed him the ball. It was a layup to win the game.
That's it, we did it. Yeah, something special.
Something special, Anderson says back at home. He wasn't quite ready to give up.
I'd kind of made up my mind that I wanted to play there for a year and then go on my mission. I did pray about it. It did feel good. I knew it was the right decision for me.
After graduating high school in early June, Anderson will head to Southern Utah for basketball camp. He's going to play for 1 year before submitting his missionary application in the summer of 2014. He won't know where he's going until he gets the call. He says he'll continue to practice on the court and grow spiritually through scripture study and prayer with his family.
A great and marvelous work is about to come forth among the children of men.
Behold, I am God. Give heed to my word, which is quick.
For the California Report, I'm Molly Gray in Los Angeles.
Dividing asunder both joints and marrow.
That story was produced in collaboration with the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Next week, our Graduation Day series continues with a profile of an undocumented high school student struggling to get out of the shadows. piles of early blueberries and cherries at local farmers' markets are a tip-off, peak season for California farmers is just around the corner. But while agriculture may provide some of California's most famous exports, the latest farm census from the USDA found that over half of the state's small farms don't even turn a profit. Rachel Dornhelm visited one family farm in Sonoma County that's using social media to try and change that while reducing food waste at the same time.
On a recent Sunday evening, after employees returned from a weekend selling at Bay Area farmers markets, Bloomfield Farms general manager Nick Papadopoulos headed over to one of the barns.
So I'm walking in the cooler, and we've got two pallets of produce that have come back.
After taking it all in,
I'm going to step out of the cooler. It's getting kind of cold in here.
Papadopoulos headed back to his shipping container-turned office and updated the farm's Facebook status.
We're going to put breaking news. Crop mob. Two pallets of Bloomfield Farms organic veggies, $150 per pallet.
This was his third try at recruiting what he dubbed crop mobsters. The deal was open to anyone. The first time, the veggies were snapped up by a block of Santa Rosa neighbors. The next week, a group of friends went in on it. This time, by Monday morning, farmer Mike Collins was helping Barry Smith Salinas load organic veggies and herbs into her truck.
I keep getting mint whiffs over here.
Oh yeah, we get a whole greenhouse full of mint whiffs.
What a mint whiffs.
Salinas lives in nearby Sebastopol and owns a local meat production business.
This morning I woke up to all these, you know, Facebook messages and people cross-posting that there was a load of produce that hadn't been picked up. So
here she was. As she tied it all down under a tarp, Salinas got a stream of messages from friends planning to gather at her commercial kitchen that night to claim their portions.
There's a lot of I'm-ins. Holding as much cabbage for me as you can. Taters.
This whole experiment in macrobiotics meets microprocessors got off the ground because Papadopoulos took a break from his job as a business consultant and went to work at his father-in-law's farm. He was struck by the waste problem when, on short notice and with limited time, he couldn't find a place to donate 32 cases of organic broccoli. They ended up in the compost bin and chicken coop.
I don't believe we should let it go to waste. I believe we should share it, donate it, whatever it takes to get it out there, and if possible, as farmers, we would like to recover a small portion of our costs.
After success with his Facebook posts, Papadopoulos recruited a local web team to build the site cropmobster.com. He says it's meant to be a hub for people involved with food production, hunger relief, or just individuals struggling to access local food. In the 6 weeks the site has been operating, nonprofits, restaurants, and individuals have swooped up over 11,000 pounds of food, including 100 heads of discounted organic lettuce from Twin Palms Ranch.
All this heat has pushed a lot of our plants way ahead of schedule, so we needed to move a lot of heads of lettuce really quick.
That's Twin Palms farmer Lewis McKenzie. He and his wife Karen had expected to harvest those greens a month later when their retail operation started. He says at his five-acre farm, every penny counts. He used to be a general contractor, making $100 an hour.
I don't know how many days' work it took to get a box, 100 heads of lettuce out to somebody for $100. It's a lot of work.
But I say we never go hungry.
So that others don't either, they've also posted food donations on Crop Mobster. Dana Gunders researches food waste for the Natural Resources Defense Council. She says a recent study found that in some cases, 30% of fresh food doesn't make it off farms. She says Crop Mobster addresses one of the main problems with waste.
And that is that it's often spontaneous, it's inconsistent, and so it's hard for anyone to really build a business off that. And the way that technology can enable this more organic solution is really powerful.
Bloomfield Farms' Nick Papadopoulos says it hasn't been without challenges. There are regulations around agriculture, and he's heard from at least one regular customer questioning why they're paying higher prices than what's on Crop Mobster. But he says gleaning food from farms is a centuries-old tradition, and it's time to do it with the latest tools available. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.
Meanwhile, an organic farm in Salinas is teaching local farmers how to protect themselves from pesticides. Sophia Collins moved to the area with her husband and children to be a farm worker. But just after 3 days, Collins began getting rashes all over her arms and legs. She believes it was a reaction to the pesticides being sprayed in the fields. As part of our occasional series, What's Your Story?, we hear from her and her son, Jay Ronghell, about how that organic farm helped change their lives.
I said, maybe this is for me because I love to grow vegetables. It's my passion.
And yeah, she used to call me and like tell me like, oh, we're like learning this and that, like about like organic agriculture, about pesticides and how they affect like humans and the plants itself. And I wasn't really paying attention at that time because, you know, I was kind of busy. But now I'm kind of like really interested in what she's really doing.
We start with green beans and beets and carrots. Right now I have strawberries. I have green beans, zucchini, soybeans, beets, cilantro, parsley, tomatoes.
I started finding clients for our business to sell. We're local clients because, you know, we want people to be eating organic. You know, and we give them a little information of, like, why, you know, why organic, so they can know.
I have 2 farmers market. I sell in King City and in Gonzales. Los Girasoles in Soledad, in King City, the Rey market.
Well, we're creating a website now which will allow us to sell to basically the world. Other families maybe here in Alba don't probably have that opportunity. Maybe they, because I studied, you know, computer science, so I should know this. So yeah, maybe other families don't know how to get online or even know how to print something or just look for information about their plants. Like if their plants are dying, they need to know why they're dying.
My dream is to have my own ranch and then to teach other people how to grow up vegetables free of pesticides.
I start teaching people about organic and just anything beneficial to your health.
My concern is how the people is getting sick. I think it's that they are exposed to pesticides, and I feel very, very bad for that. I would like many people be healthy for many, many years.
Sophia Collins and her son Jay work at Alba Organics, a Salinas farm teaching people how to be independent farmers. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Thanks to our interns, Guy Marzorati and Gina Shalaba. We had production help from Shuka Kalantari. Our editorial team includes Victoria Maleone, Ingrid Becker, Andrea Kissick, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Endowment. Health happens in schools at calendow.org.